is for this morning, if it's okay, is to have like a talk until maybe about 50 minutes, then have a toilet break, and then at 9 o'clock do the metta meditation closing. Will that affect the people who are helping with the kitchen?
No.
Okay. You're not eating today. Trent's maybe, okay, yeah. Very good. So about 50 minutes talk and then 10 minute toilet break, then come back for the loving kindness meditation and closing remarks. Very good. So, as usual, these retreats are very fast, and it's simply because that when you stay in a moment and you are enjoying the present, then it means that you have, you don't think of time. When you don't think of time, then of course it passes, you know, easily. If you're worried about something happened or you're scared about something happened, it just changes the perception of time. But anyway, at this time of the retreat, it's an opportunity just to review what we've been doing here. And on this retreat, kidnap. So sleeping, okay. You can't go sleeping during my talk, but you make him sort of sit up, so he's a bit more respectful. Okay. So first of all, you see, on this retreat, there's a little bit of fun and joy, and of course I learned that from an Ajahn Chah, and who was a very funny monk, and who could look at life in a different way. And when you are laughing, you're laughing at yourselves. You're laughing at life. And it's a much better way to laugh at life rather than to get upset and angry at life. In fact, I noticed the only people you see who never laugh are dead people. I've seen many corpses in coffins. I've never seen a dead person laugh. So that's a sign that you're alive. You are laughing. And it's also, it's great for the health. And it means you're not taking life so seriously. Yeah, life is serious, but sometimes we can hold on to it so rigidly, so tightly, and it just becomes a big, heavy burden for us. And sometimes we see the funny side of it, which is what you do when you actually stand back and see what's happening. An example of that was, I think I mentioned this in an interview, but not in the talks, is the movies. And for the guys, mostly, the football on TV. Because that was a case where in Changi Airport, which I often go through, you're going to go there later on, I think in Terminal 3, between the A gates and the B gates, there's a big sports lounge, and they're always playing soccer on these big screens. And I always, as I go past, I don't sit down and watch it, got more sense. But I see these guys, and they're down there watching the football, and then suddenly you see them jump up, and they shout at the screen, or they shout at the referee, that wasn't a penalty, that was offside, that was wrong, they should be sent off, get out the red card, that's not a red card. And they really shout. And then I look a bit closer, and it's always a replay. All the shouting won't influence anything. And it's usually happening in UK somewhere. So it doesn't matter how loud you shout in Singapore, they can't hear it. Have you ever seen people doing that on a sports match? It may be in Singapore and it may be like Olympic Games somewhere, and you still shout. Why do people do that? And it's the same as a story when I remember we went with my friends and our girlfriends, we went to the movies one night, and we were watching West Side Story. It's my West Side Story story. And I don't know how many of you know that movie. It's really an old movie. It's, It's based on Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare's tragedy of two ill-starred lovers, you know, from families which will never sort of get on together. And so Tony fell in love with Maria. I think Tony was Puerto Rican, I think Maria was Italian or something. And anyway, they, you know, difficult upbringings, very poor, struggling to get by. And then what happened was, there was all sorts of accidents and stuff, and Tony killed Maria's brother. And Maria's other brother was out to get him. I'm not going to let this go. And so Maria was in the dark streets of the West Side in New York, in the night, trying to find her lover, trying to warn him, trying to say that, be careful, you know, my other brother has lost it and he's got a gun and is trying to find you and shoot you. And she was searching all over, and then finally she saw Tony, and Tony was under one of these lamppost streetlights, and it was raining, and it was dark in the middle of the night, and she shouted out to Tony to warn him, and at that moment, a gunshot rang out. Her brother had also seen him at the same time. And it was a dead hit in his chest. And so Maria ran over to the lamppost and put her arms around her dying lover, Tony. And somewhere in the streets of New York, this was many, 1960s, a darkness. It was an orchestra. And the orchestra started playing. And even though they were dying, instead of ringing for an ambulance, they started singing. There's a place for us. Somewhere, a place for us. And all our girlfriends, they started sobbing. They were weeping. Oh, so sad. And all the guys, including sensitive me, were laughing. We knew what was going to happen. We liked only a movie. But they really got involved in it. And I told my girlfriend afterwards, look, you know I'm a Buddhist, you know I believe in reincarnation. Let's now watch the next round of the movie. You'll see that Tony gets reincarnated again. You get same old, same old. But it wasn't just a joke, because I started to wonder why it is that when you see a movie or a football match, which is really enthralling, you get sucked in. It's like your mind is actually there in the West Side in New York. You know, trying to sometimes feel distant out. Tony, look out! You know, when they're in the cinema theatre and it's just a movie. But you get sucked in, even a football match, simply because after a while, as I said, your mind fits into the screen. And your psychology is that you're right there in New York watching this. You're right there at Anfield, just now watching the soccer match. You're in the stands there somewhere. That's what it feels like. That's why people shout out. That's what they say. Look out! That's not a goal! And that's what happens there. You get sucked into the action. If you could just stand back a little bit, you know it's not real. It's just a replay of a game. It's just a movie. It's not real, but we like to think it's real. We get right inside of it and we think we're there. And that's so often what happens with life. Life can sometimes really get emotionally entangled with us. It's like we don't know how to just stand back and get some distance and just to see it from a distance. And when we see it from a distance, it's very easy to deal with. When you're right inside of it, many of you may be wondering what you're going to do when you get home and next Monday go and work with your boss. Already when you think about that, even the thoughts you get emotionally entangled with, you get sucked in there. And it's like being there with your boss, planning what you're going to say, what you're going to do, and getting emotionally involved. But that's in the future, quite a couple of days away. and a long distance away, why don't we just stand back and see all of those problems and troubles in the distance? And then when we put some space between us and the difficulties of our life, it's so easy to get perspective. It's no big deal. Yeah, you may just have a bit of trouble there, but you only go to work for a few hours a day. 8-9 hours a day, most of the day you're not working. Certainly not with the boss all the time. And anyway, talking about those bosses, there's a wonderful way of dealing with them, of dealing with those difficult people. And it brings up, you know, the loving kindness, which is coming up later. And that's a story. I like repeating these stories because they are powerful, they are real. We can say all theories about spreading loving kindness to all beings, but how do you actually do that? And what's the real effect? Does it work? And that was this disciple Julie over in Sydney, years and years ago, that she had a little business, fashion business. She's very good at it. But at the same time, she had this little daughter, a baby. She asked me to name it, and I gave her the name Surya, like sunshine. And at the same time that the English name was Holly. And she got, she's negotiating her contract, and the people in London called her and said, yeah, we're ready to sign. And it's one of those contracts which takes your business up to the next level. So it was really important for her. She discussed it with her husband, and he took a few days off work to look after the kid, Holly. And she got the first available flight to Heathrow. And, you know, not expensive flight. Checked into a cheap hotel and tired, jet-lagged. But this was important. So she only had a chance to shower, change clothes, and then go to the office to meet the board and the CEO. And that was when that she got into the boardroom. And the directors were there, but not the CEO. And when she announced who she was, they said, you've wasted your time. You might as well just go back to the hotel and get on the next flight back to Sydney. There is no way in the world that the CEO is going to sign a contract for you. He's in a really bad mood. He's really upset and angry. He's been shouting and swearing at everybody. And he's not going to sign a contract for you. But of course, if you've gone to all that trouble, you know, flying halfway around the world, you know, you're not going to just, you know, give up that easily. So she said, I'll wait for him. Suit yourself. But she didn't just wait for him like normal people would, having a cup of coffee and going over arguments. She just sat down in the corner of the boardroom and crossed her legs and started meditating. On the loving kindness, may all beings be happy and well. May all beings in the whole world, Mr. Trump, Mr. Kim, may all beings be happy and well. And she was, you know, she's good at this. She had a very good teacher. I always say, I don't know if you know this, but I'm actually, was nominated for the most humble monk of the world. You know who nominated me? I did. Anyway, so there she was in the boardroom. And then the CEO came in after about 10 or 15 minutes. And I imagine you're a CEO in an English company, really stressed out. And you go in your boardroom and you see this, you know, this young woman, a blonde-haired young woman sitting in the corner, cross-legged, meditating. That's not what the CEO expected. In fact, he really blew up. What does she think she's doing in my boardroom? But actually, much worse than that. But I am a very sort of sensitive monk, as well as being the most humble monk. So all those words which were really said, I can't share those with you. So he swore at her and watched him, get out now! And, of course, when you've been meditating, very peaceful, they can shout at you, but you can't move very quickly. So she just very slowly opened her eyes, and she sort of stood up, and he was glaring at her, just like some monster, you know, from the walls of those Thai temples with big bulging eyes, like what I saw in my Nimitta. And she went right up to him. It's amazing that when you've had some nice meditation, you're not at all afraid of anything. You just, even my preceptor who passed away, you know, some years ago, Somdet Buddhajan, even though he was an administrating monk, a very great scholar, but he said when he was a young monk studying, I think it was in Gok Samoy, that's where his family was. When he was studying being a monk, he did some meditation, sat under a tree in the forest, and when he opened his eyes, after the end of the meditation, there was a big snake caught up in his lap. And it was a very dangerous, venomous snake. He said one of the most wonderful things was he wasn't at all scared. Because of the meditation, the fear had just vanished. He didn't know where. So this was very weird. Because normally, a snake like that, you know, you'd be really terrified. But for him, it was just a nice little snake, you know, warm in his lap. Just, for him, it was just like having a teddy bear on your lap. Only teddy bears aren't so dangerous. He was just very peaceful. He just sat there for a little while. And then after a while the snake just uncurled and went off and did its thing. And that's what happens when you meditate. Sometimes afterwards the fear is just not there. It's quite strange. But anyway, the girl went straight up to the boss. No fear at all. Really peaceful. And she said the first thing which came into her head. She looked the boss in the eyes. And she said to this really angry, stressed out boss, "You've got such beautiful blue eyes, just like my baby Holly back in Sydney." And that's, you try that to your boss. Tell him how beautiful his eyes are. And she said the boss just did not know how to cope with something like that. It was like the wheels in his brain were running at full speed and getting clogged up because he hadn't learned how to deal with this. The word was, and I think many of you know that word by now, it's one of my favorite words, totally discombobulated. You may not know what the word means, but as it sounds, discombobulated means just totally confused, not knowing what to do. And he couldn't speak, he was just dumbstruck. And so after a minute or two, you know, that the only response possible. His face softened and he smiled. And he said to her, "Really? I've got beautiful blue eyes." And then he said, "Well, oh, you want this contract signed?" "Yes, certainly." And he signed the contract there and then. And then he went off to do some other business. He had a contract signed through loving kindness, through some meditation. And at the end of that, she's really tired and came all that way. Wanted to just, you know, go and have a rest in her room and then catch the evening flight back to Sydney. But she couldn't. Because all the directors, she said they formed a ring around me, encircled me and said, "We're not letting you go until you teach us how the heck you did that." That was a miracle, they said. "We need to learn that." And that's what actually happened. So she had to teach a little bit of loving kindness meditation when she saw some of its power. But the point is that when you do some meditation, you can stand back from things. It's just a boss getting angry. Don't get sucked in there. So when you see now find something which is really nice about your boss. You know, he's got a beautiful tie or something. Or he's got, I don't know what he's got. He's got a nice haircut. I don't know what he's got. But anyway, if he's like many people these days, the tough bosses, they like to have bald heads. Amazing how many people shave their hair these days. Mm-hmm. You know, like Bruce Willis, you know. What was it? Die Hard. And so if your boss has got a bald head, you just go out to him and say, "Oh, you've got such a beautiful bald head like my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, back in Perth." And see what he says. So what it's doing is you don't get sucked into stuff. You can actually stand at a distance. And it's amazing, you can see different ways of doing things. So that's one of the reasons why with the meditation we do here, we do that in a lot of skillful means. We know how to deal with things which other people get so confused with. And of course, you know, I don't know why this is, but so many people, they get concerned when somebody dies. You know, we're all going to die sometimes. But why is it that when people pass away, it really affects our lives? And why are you scared for? In fact, most of you are going to be flying soon, this evening or tomorrow, and you know the aircrafts they do crash. You know, even Singapore Airlines and other, you know, Air New Guinea had a crash the other day, Qantas. So sometimes no one dies, but who knows? It's only a matter of time before Singapore Airlines has a crash. So what are you going to do? Are you prepared? I'm prepared. I'm always prepared. If my aircraft has a crash, I've got my own parachute. Just hold the four corners. It's a big rope. Just hold the four corners and go floating down. And I think that's probably where the idea that monks can levitate came from. But no, you know the sort of the positive thinking which I always have. You can look at things in so many different ways. So look at things in a positive way. And for death, especially aircraft, I always think that's a wonderful way to die. People say die in your sleep. So, I don't think that's really such a good way. But dying in an aircraft explosion is a much better way. Remember the three advantages for dying in an aircraft at 36,000 feet? The three benefits? Number one, cremation is done on the spot. You don't have to book a time to do the cremation. It doesn't cost any money. You know, I don't know how much cremations cost in Singapore, but they're, you know, pretty expensive. You have to get the box and go and all that sort of stuff. Here it's just, and also if it's an aircraft explosion, they give an extra benefit, you know, just the free of cost, is your ashes get scattered for free. That's the first benefit. And of course the second benefit is just how easy it is to arrange and how cheap. I've been to funeral services in Singapore. You have the body there and, you know, in a big hall or somewhere, and all the people come to eat for days. And some of the people you don't even know they were related to you, they just come for the food, I reckon. And it takes days and days and days to eat. And it costs a lot of money. You die in an aircraft explosion, it's for free. Actually, it's better than actually for nothing, because you usually get insurance payout from the airline. So you actually make money out of your grandma's death. But last of all, you know the last benefit, which is by far the best. That when you die at 36,000 feet, you're so close to heaven, it's easy to go the rest of the way. You're right next door. So, okay, you may think that's a bit facetious, but it is looking at things in a positive way. Why not? So when we actually stand back, we can look at all sorts of things in a really, really, really good way. And for those people left behind, those ones who are grieving, I must admit that I can never really understand grief. I looked at things in a different way even when I was young. I mentioned to you when my father died, I was only 16. I never cried at his death, never cried afterwards. And even though you know some of those stories of my father, you know, the opening the door of your heart story, or even one of the other stories, which I'm sure you know all the stories with my father, that I was about 10, 11 years of age, and I got a place in the school football team. And I told my dad, really excited, I'm going to play in the school football team, you know, on Saturday morning. And he said, can you come and watch me? He said, no, I'm working on Saturday morning. I can't get off. I have to work. And of course, you're really disappointed. And having known how disappointed you would be, imagine how I felt when I was playing soccer there in that game on Saturday morning. And I saw my father on the touchline cheering me on. He actually came. I asked him afterwards, I thought you were supposed to be working. He said, yeah, but don't tell the boss, because I told the boss that I had a series of injections on Saturday morning organized by my doctor, so I have to take an hour off every Saturday morning for the next few weeks. So, you know, he never really taught me the fourth precept about not lying. But he certainly did sort of, you know, show me his commitment to his children. And he'd almost do anything for us, even risk his job. So you can imagine how much I loved him for that. And so when he actually died, so I wasn't sad. It was really weird. And of course it took me many years later to find out why. And that's where you got the simile of the concert. It's just looking at things in a different way. And this is what meditation does. You can look at the boss as a really angry person or someone with beautiful blue eyes. Or look at death as, you know, something really important has been taken away from me. But instead I thought of what I'd had. 16 years with a wonderful man. And so, that's where I got the simile of the concert. I'd love going to listen to music when I was young. You know, of course, growing up in London, this amazing sort of music was happening there. You know, not only the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and all these amazing bands. For those people who like rock music, I went to the first concert of Led Zeppelin, very first one in the Marquee Club in London. And I also remember just with my brother going to this pub in the North London, and the top story of the pub, or upstairs in the pub, we were sitting down there, and the band was going to play, but only 36 people in the audience. And that's all. My brother and I were two of those. And I expected the band not to play for us, but they did. And the lead singer was Rod Stewart. You know, the good old days when he was just not really known. So he had all these wonderful experiences, and also classical music and jazz. And I remember seeing Miles Davis and, Johnny Cochrane. All those amazing people, one of some of the best musicians in the world. But when the concert was over, you know what happens? After the end of a great concert, everybody stands up and shouts for more. It's the encore. They always have an encore. Even my father had an encore. He came very close to dying many times. But then he managed to pull himself through and just carry on for a while. But then, of course, after the encore had finished, there has to come the time when the band is finished. I have to go home, and I have to go home another way. And, of course, I knew the music had finished. But I never cried, ever, at the end of a great performance. Even though I knew I would never hear that musician again. I never cried. Instead, I felt so uplifted. What a wonderful performance that was. And how lucky I was to have been there at the time. I felt inspired. And that was my own father's funeral. And other funerals which I've been to. I never feel sad. I thought, wow, what a wonderful performance that was. How great that life was. I felt so privileged to be a part of it in a small or a bigger way. There's nothing sad about that. There was a sense of, well, no, it really was a sweet and sour celebration. Thank you so much. So a lot of the meditation is learning how to see things in a different way, a positive way. All the tears in the world don't bring the loved one back. And all the funeral eulogies and all of the time after the funeral, they never erase the memories. That's something which is in your heart and in your memory forever. All the memories of, you know, your time with your parents and loved ones. So those are the things which you look at things in a different way. Sometimes I think this world is a bit crazy. They always say that, oh, now the love of my life is gone, there will never be any happiness for me at all. My life is ruined forever. And a year later they're usually having a good time again. You know, sometimes that At the time, you know, the hand right in front of the face, you think, this is it, I can't go on. But then, afterwards, you find your life does go on. So when you look at the big picture, you don't just go focusing just on the tragedy of the moment, or the anger of the boss in the moment, or your disease in this moment, or your tragedy of today. But you see a bigger picture. The life becomes far more interesting, meaningful. Especially the word meaningful. Because sometimes that when a tragedy or difficulty happens, you say, why? And so often that it's a meaning which people are looking for. Why? Why does this happen? And that's where on the very uplifting subject of funerals and death, that is why this old monk in Thailand, years and years ago, he sort of mentioned the story of, it's actually the same monk. It's fascinating, this old monk living in the jungles in a hut by himself. He said one night, you know, there was a knocking on his door. And there's no one in the jungle. You know, and there are such things as ghosts and spirits, but he was a strong monk, didn't worry about spirits or ghosts. So he opened the little door of his hut, and there was a monkey with a dead baby in its arms. And the monkey was knocking on the door of the monk's hut, thinking that this monk, now the monkey would usually be very afraid of the monkey, of the monk, but was desperate, you know, grieving for the little baby that had just been born. I was hoping the monk had some magic or medicine to heal the little baby, and just handed the little baby to the monk. And of course the monk took a look at it, and the little baby monkey was dead. And he couldn't do very much, but just, you know, looked into the eyes of the mother monkey. I think he said he did some chanting, and just give some loving kindness, and then handed the baby back, and the monkey just went away. It's just a very sweet story, that when you live in those jungles, you become part of the community there, and even the birds and the monkeys and others, they look after you, you look after them. Oh, what about the... I told one tsunami story about the tsunami ghost, but the tsunami crocodile. This was in Sri Lanka. And there was a man who, before he'd go to work, would go to the edge of the lagoon to feed the fish, you know, with some bread. And it was just one way of just doing something good for others, in this case, good for the fish, every morning. Before he went to work, just, you know, a bit of good karma. He could have given that bread to the monks, but the monks were already fat and the fish were a bit hungry. So he gave a couple of slices of bread to the fish. And then one day this crocodile came to the edge. And so he had some more bread, so he gave a slice of bread to the crocodile as well. And from that day, the crocodile would come every day for a slice of bread, just a bit of a treat. Every day, take a slice of bread and then go away. And of course, what happened about a couple of weeks later, a few weeks later, the tsunami came in the morning. So he was just out there feeding the fish. And then the wave came and washed him away, this Sri Lankan gentleman. And, you know, he described what it was like, you know, in this really heavy currents. He said, you know, he saw like a chair, a wooden chair. He tried to grab onto it. You think it was easy, but the current just ripped it away from him. And he was going further and further out to sea, you know, really scared, because the current was really incredibly strong. And then he saw a log of wood and grabbed onto that. Fortunately, it was bigger, and he could actually hold onto it. And then he was just really confused, you know, just getting his breath. At least his head was above water, holding onto the log of wood. And that's when, you know, he started to get his senses back. He noticed something very, very strange. Everything else was floating out to sea, but the log of wood was going towards the land. And when it got close enough to the edge of the land, he just could jump off and climb up. And he saw, as you all guessed, it wasn't a log of wood. It was his crocodile. Crocodiles eat people. But this crocodile preferred bread. Must have been a vegetarian, I don't know. But some cynics say, "Ah, oh, that crocodile is just selfishness. He knew if they'd let the guy die, he wouldn't have any bread tomorrow morning." No, it's not like that at all. It's if you're kind to others, others will be kind to you. They'll look after you and serve you. So there's a nice little story about when you're sort of part of nature, the nature looks after you, you look after nature. And it's wonderful when that sort of happens. So anyway, there was this crocodile saved the man, and this monkey, just, you know, the monks couldn't help. But at least he gave a little bit of kindness to have a look and do some chanting for the poor monkey. And afterwards, so that was the same monk who, in that forest, in that hut, there was a big storm. And, you know, with those storms, the trees, sometimes big branches came thundering down onto the ground, and then trees were uprooted, they came crashing down. And, you know, he was up all night because just one tree, or one heavy branch, if that hit his hut, it would have gone straight through the thatched roof. And there was no protection there. And so he was up all night, and he heard quite a lot of thuds and thumps close by, but nothing actually hit his hut. So he was safe, he survived. But that's where in the morning he went out to have a look, see what the damage was. And that's where he saw all the leaves which had been torn from the trees the night before. Most of the leaves were old brown leaves. But on the floor, amongst those old brown leaves, was a few green leaves. And even some really fresh green leaves. The colour was telling him that those leaves would have only shot forth the day before. They were baby leaves. They had been torn from the tree and lay dead on the floor with all the old brown ones. And then he said he looked up to see what leaves were left on the tree. And most of the leaves left on the tree were the green leaves, the strong, healthy leaves. But even though a lot of young green leaves lay dead on the floor, there were still a few old brown curled up leaves still clinging on to the twigs and branches. Just like human beings, even though like young people pass away, even babies, still there's some old grandmas and grandpas and great still clinging on, curled up and brown. But that's what happens when storms go through our community. They mostly take the old leaves, the old ones. They also take a few young ones as well. And I've told that many times to people who have lost a young person from their lives, a child or a baby. And they say, why? Why does that happen? For the same reason when the storms go through the forests, they always take some young green leaves as well as the old brown leaves as well. That's nature, that's life. It's not like something has gone wrong. That's a world in which we live. And we make peace with that world when we realize it's not a mistake which someone can fix up. It is our life. And anyway, when those young ones die, they're the ones who usually get reincarnated again. Especially the ones who die. A nice little weird story. There was this... well, I think it's okay to say. There was this young Sri Lankan boy. And he was... How old was he? Manuka. Eight years of age. He was cycling to school one morning. You know, always fit, nothing wrong with him. And then he just felt, you know, a bit sort of sickly. He got off his bike, sat by the side of the road, and then passed away. And his father, you know, knew, I think dropped off the daughter or something, and knew that something was wrong. So went there and saw him passed out and took him to hospital. He had, what was it, say, this congenital defect of the lungs, and it gave him like a heart attack and he died. So I went there to the ICU because they were just devastated. I was surprised that, you know, that he died like that. And so the whole school, you know, came to the funeral service, and I mentioned it happens very often that somebody who dies like that usually comes back. And so, a couple of months later, the mum got pregnant, and then finally she gave birth. And, you know, she swears it looks like him. What was really weird was as soon as it was born, you know, it got taken home, but then it had some lung infections. So it got straight back to hospital and went to the same bed with the same doctor with the same equipment in the hospital. And the doctors were, hey, you know, didn't we see you about a year ago with your other son? And it was all over, all the same again. Only this time, because he had the same condition, the same sort of infection. But this time, because they got there really quickly, the doctors healed. It was like, as that kid died, even though he was an 8-year-old, when a new kid came along, the baby, it was actually almost continuing on where it left off in the previous life. Really weird. But anyway, so that was their new kid. But even more interesting than that about kids who die, there was a couple, this is actually the same couple who had the same couple who had the ghost who could ring the doorbell. And this was without electricity. This was the couple who, they could ring the doorbell, but their first child, when it was, during her pregnancy, prenatal care, everything was going well except for the last few days. They had an ultrasound about 5 or 6 days before birth, but it was stillborn. The boy was named Charlie, because I went to the funeral service, performed that for them. So perfectly formed young man, but he'd actually twisted and obstructed the blood supply in his umbilical cord in the womb. And they hadn't noticed it, so when it was born, it was already dead. So it's obviously, for a mother to have a baby stillborn is a great tragedy, but it's not the end of the world, it's not the end of Charlie either. So what they did in Thailand, which is, in fact you should do this in Singapore if ever this happens, they got a biro pen and they drew a line on the heel, straight line on the heel. Now you're not supposed to have birthmarks on the heel, but they were waiting. If that was Charlie, come back again, he would have the same birthmark. And of course, it was a healthy young woman, so she became pregnant soon and gave birth to a girl called Annie, who's got a birthmark on her heel, a line. It was Charlie, come back again. Only this time it was a girl. So I know that some women love this story, but I say that, you know, because when it got the first time was Charlie, it didn't really have enough. You would say it hasn't got enough good karma to make it, almost make it into this life, but not quite. So usually the second pregnancy, you know, monks, you know, do more chanting, they offer more sort of robes or donations, they increase the baby's karma. So it did, it had much more karma than last time. So this time it was born as a girl. I thought some of you would like that. Well, it was fascinating though that, you know, I used to come to the Nolamara temple and would always play with the boys. You know the idea of a tomboy, you know, just dresses rough and strong. The first years of his life it would be like the tomboy because it was a boy before. Or even weirder than that. You don't mind weird stories. The weird story, this was a monastery over in Thailand that somebody offered the monks this monkey because they'd seen a monkey in the market, you know, being sort of a tiny cage, really being sort of mistreated. And, you know, well, I don't know what they would have done with it, put it in a cage and poked it and even eaten it. I'm not quite sure what they would have done, but somebody brought it out of compassion. Once they brought it, they let it go in a forest monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And of course, you know, the monks were always really kind. So the little monkey soon became very, very protective and loved the monks there. And every time in the afternoon they had tea time for the monks, you know, they had a cup of tea about 3 or 4 o'clock. The little monkey also had to have a cup of tea with the other monks. And so the monkey would be holding his cup of tea with all the other monks. He was part of the gang, if you like. A very cute little monkey. But then the monkey was like, you know, was very protective, and whenever there was a noisy car went past, he would chase it. And of course one day he chased it and he got run over by a lorry and killed. But the head monk there, he should not have done this. The head monk just watched the stream of consciousness go from the monkey's body and go into the village where, because the monks would always go on the arms round in the village, they knew everyone in the village. There was a young woman there who was pregnant. And the abbot, this monk, told everybody, oh yeah, the stream of consciousness of that monkey has gone into that woman's body. And because he told everybody, all the monks, they couldn't wait until this woman gave birth to find out, you know, what came out. Because, you know, this great monk, he wouldn't sort of lie. He said that was the monkey before, has now taken rebirth as a human being in the village. And I wasn't there when the woman gave birth or afterwards, but all the monks, they all told me. So that baby was exceptionally hairy for a human being. So if ever you have a kid and you say you're a little monkey, you don't know how truthful that could be. In that case, it was. He was a little monkey before, and they knew his name before. Anyway, where am I going with this? I'm supposed to be talking about my, when you get to some meditation, it's not just to get jhanas and enlightenment. So I say that because it's a meditation retreat. It puts some things in perspective, the big picture. But also, it just amazes you just how it helps so many other little things in your life, which you never expected. You know, sometimes just learning how to relax and let go and be peaceful. I was telling someone the other day that maybe because my father had asthma, that's one of the reasons he's always sick. That's one of the reasons the boss believed that he had to have those injections on a Saturday morning because he did have asthma. But I never got asthma, but I did get some allergies. I remember this one time, you know, it should have killed me. I had a very bad allergy. Never really understood exactly why, but I think it was probably the, what's it called, walnuts. Because afterwards, you know, you have a really bad allergic reaction. You come out in hives all over. Incredibly itchy and you can't breathe. So, what's it, that's an anaphylactic or whatever. Mm. Yeah. And any sensible person would have, you know, called an ambulance. But instead, you know, I just couldn't breathe and had all these hives all over the body. And then, like, little bumps all over. And then I just sat on the bench and meditated. Just calmed everything down. So I didn't need to breathe that much. Until about an hour. And afterwards, you know, you can still have difficulty breathing, but, you know, not that bad. And, you know, the hives had gone down mostly, and so I went home. And sometimes what you can do when you can meditate, it's amazing, sort of the different ways you can look after problems, you know, in your life. Even just, I was going to say that many people these days do have anxiety and anxiety attacks and problems. And you know, that's why they're just being aware of your body, knowing how it works, and the interaction between the mind and the body really helps enormously. So this was the case, a real story. young lady over in Adelaide, and had really chronic anxiety. So much that she couldn't get out of bed in the morning, out of fear of, you know, what was the other side of the door. You know, and people looking at her or whatever. And, you know, she did have a boyfriend, Lloyd, and she was at University of Adelaide, very smart kid. But even the psychiatrists, the doctors, no one could help her. And she was really in a mess, not being able to get out of bed. Anxiety was incredible. And so what happened is this, fortunately that her uncle was a strong supporter of ours. Oh, he's going to be in the monastery today, the uncle. And said, go and ring up Ajahn Brahm. Doesn't cost anything that I do. Good value for money. And that's when she said about her anxiety. You will always notice that any emotion you have will always be expressed on the body somewhere. If you're anger, you know, if you see the face tighten up. You know, if you're in love, you can read the bodies, but with anxiety, that's manifested on the body. And I know that, and I asked the girl, I said, when you get an anxiety attack, where do you feel it on your body? She said, oh, in my chest. And I said, not good enough. You know, you're doing science. She was actually doing dentistry. And I said, I want coordinates, millimeters, from your navel, up to the left to the right. Where's it centered? And when you do have an anxiety, when it's manifested on your body, is it like a circle or a square or an oval? How wide is it? I gave her something to do called mindfulness. Be aware of that feeling. And so, give me a call in a few days. He gave me a call. Said, yeah, I've followed your instructions, Ajahn Brahm. And when I get these anxiety attacks, it's so many millimeters up from my navel, and it's a little bit to the left, and it's like an oval, it extends so much this way and that way. It was just a trick to get her really to be aware of what that feeling, where it manifests. I said, well, describe it to me. What does it feel like? She said, well, it's just tense, throbbing. I said, that's not good enough. I want a detailed description. And now, like a two-page essay on the feelings in your chest when you have anxiety attack. And so that's what she did. She gave me this amazing description of what it felt like and how it developed, how long it lasted. I said, right, next thing I want you to do is, now you're aware of it, kindness. So now you're aware of it. Next time you get an anxiety attack, so take your hand and massage it. Massage it really softly and really with a lot of tenderness and kindness and compassion. And if you feel that you can't do that, get your boyfriend Lloyd to do it. I don't think boys would mind doing that if that's your girlfriend. So that's what he did. And afterwards, she gave me a call, said, did you do that? Yeah. What happened? And he said, well, just now, after massaging it, that tightness, that throbbing went away. I said, great. What happened to the anxiety? And that's when she had this wonderful pause, the eureka moment. He said, when the physical manifestation, the counterpart went, so did the anxiety. I said, okay, now you know how to deal with the anxiety. And so every time she had an anxiety attack, she had her hand and she knew where it was, mindful, and she just rubbed her chest. The counterpart of the anxiety. It's very hard to rub your mind, because you're not quite sure where that is and how it works. So she did it on her chest. A few days later, she was out of bed. A week later or two, she was back at college. And at the end of the year, she graduated, first class honours. Another year later, in the sunken gardens at University of Western Australia, that I did the marriage blessing for her and Lloyd. They got married. And they had to have me there. They could have got married in Adelaide, but nope. We've got to get Ajahn Brahm. My mind, thank you for saving my life. Which was true. It's amazing what you can do. There's another, right, I'm just going way over time as usual. Another lady over in Eastern Europe who sent this email to our admin secretary, Dimi, that she had chronic arthritis. I don't know if you ever had arthritis or seen people with arthritis. You know, you get almost like crippled with the arthritis. And she had to have these really strong painkillers. The only way she could get through the day. But the painkillers had rotten side effects. And then she never came here, but she saw all this information on YouTube. And she wrote this wonderful letter back saying, thank you so much for teaching me just this kindfulness. Because now I don't need any painkillers. Because I've got no arthritis. It's gone. And having seen people with arthritis, and that's there, you know, all the day and night, you have to spot it out with painkillers. To see that was just a wonderful thing. This meditation can do so much, you know, to overcome physical problems, fears, anxieties. So it's not just about getting enlightened. It's not just about getting limiters. So don't go away thinking, oh, I never got any limiters on this retreat. That was really terrible. I'm going to ask Ai Ling and the Buddhist Bodhinyana for my money back. You'll be surprised that even though you may not have got limiters, some of you would have, but still, you go home enhanced. With wisdom and compassion, of just seeing that much of your mind and how it interacts with the body, a lot has been done. So there we go. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. At least you know how to do sadhu properly, that's what you learn. So, have a toilet break in 10 minutes, well, that's be 9:10. We'll come back and we'll do the loving kindness meditation followed by just a bit of chanting to close off.